The title of Lee Child's latest Jack Reacher thriller is Never Go Back, but in this 18th installment, the vigilante drifter is forced to go against that advice and revisit his past life as the commanding officer of a military police unit in Virginia, face a run-in with an arms-dealing gangbanger in L.A., and deal with a paternity suit from a woman he doesn't remember ever meeting. It's published by Delacorte Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Lee Child back to our show today. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
I almost said Jack Reacher.
It's a common mistake, yeah.
When this book opens, Reacher has just arrived at his old MP post in Virginia. Why has he returned there?
Well, that's a great question, because never go back is pretty much Reacher's philosophy. I mean, he's always interested in moving forward. He's not interested in what has happened. He's interested in what is going to happen. And yet his freedom actually gives him a peculiarity, in as much as he can go anywhere he wants, and therefore he's liable to go somewhere for the flimsiest of pretexts or for no reason at all. And a few books back, he was talking to a woman on the phone who occupies his old job, literally sitting at his old desk in his old chair, running the unit that Reacher used to run. He's on the phone with her because he needs some small piece of information, but he becomes fascinated by her voice, by her personality, by her seeming competence. She's a woman he wants to meet.
And that was four novels ago.
Yeah, that was
2010, 61 hours.
That's right. It was.
He's been trying to get back all this time?
Yeah, and as you know, he keeps getting interrupted. He keeps getting snagged by problems that he runs into on the road, but finally he's now there. And, you know, his principle of never going back is a sound one, because when he arrives back, there's a world of trouble. The woman is not there. There's a strange man at the desk. There is all kinds of trouble brewing out of the old files. He should have stayed away, but he wanted to meet her. And as he says at one point in the book, I just wanted to take you to dinner. And look what a lot of trouble it caused.
He is told by the new commander that he's been recalled to the army. Is that something that can actually happen? Can someone who's been out of the military for years be recalled at a moment's notice?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a period during which you are subject to recall, having left. And I expanded a little bit of poetic license, in as much as his previous status with his security clearance meant that the fine print extended that period pretty much forever. Yeah, the conceit of the book is that he is recalled to the army in order to pin him down.
So you had to study American military law?
Yeah, I mean, I have a law degree from years ago, and I love...
But you're British, and I don't know if you ever served in the British military.
No, I mean, it's all unknown to me, but it's... other writers would call it research, and for me, it's not so much research. I just find stuff fascinating, and I love reading laws. I love reading... the history of laws, how things happened, how they've been changed. And generally speaking, you can entertain yourself really well just by reading the history of a piece of legislation.
Could this series have been written about a British drifter who had been in the military?
That's a really good question, and I don't think it can. I don't think it could have been written because...
Well, it's a smaller country. He wouldn't have as much area to cover.
Well, exactly. That's the point. Literally not as much area. I mean, Britain is a very tiny, compact island, and it's also very densely populated. So the idea of big horizons, empty spaces, secrets happening... you know, in America, I think it is perfectly plausible that you get out west, you come across these isolated little towns that could have a secret brewing for a decade or so. Could not happen in Britain. Everybody knows everybody else's business. Everybody lives cheek by jowl. And just the psychological dynamic is wrong in Britain. If you read British fiction, it's all very internal, inside people's heads, inside tiny neighborhoods. There's no big geography to it.
So you mentioned he returns and he... probably shouldn't have. He's been recalled so he can be charged with a murder he's alleged to have committed 16 years before when he was in the army. He's also facing a paternity suit from a romantic liaison he doesn't remember having. And can you be charged with adultery in the military?
Yeah, adultery is still a criminal offense in the military. Typically, it's about adultery between two serving officers, the idea that one serving officer and a civilian would be called adultery. It is technically, but it's unlikely to be prosecuted, but it still is technically a crime.
And then he learns that Susan Turner, the woman who he wound up dinner with, has also been arrested on a charge of bribery, and the plot revolves around how they managed to escape from the military prison with no car, weapons, money, or ID so that they can prove their innocence. When you're writing a book like this, do you set up the problem and then figure out how to solve it?
Yeah, that's how I do it. I imagine a big problem, and I don't have the solution in my mind because I want that same feeling that I hope the reader is going to get. I want to sit down every day thinking, what on earth is going to happen next? How is he going to get out of this? And I feel that if I knew already, if I'd made the outline, if I'd plotted it out beforehand, I feel that I wouldn't have that same excitement, and I think that would show through in the writing.
So you don't even do outlines?
No outline, no plan, no real idea of where it's going. As long as each page is a challenge, that's enough for me.
In this story, the military police, the FBI, local police departments, and other law enforcement agencies all get together, tangled up in this case. How did you go about researching the relationship between these entities? Because there's a popular perception that they're always involved in turf wars, fighting over jurisdictions, and they never do cooperate.
I think that's largely true. I mean, I think it's exaggerated in movies and television and so on, but from what I've heard from the real serving people, that tends to be true, and I think that's typical in all walks of life. If you have the chance to make a score for your department, you're going to do that rather than share it with somebody else. But I think there's a substantial degree of cooperation. And what interested me about this book, writing it, because I wrote it last year, obviously, you write it 1 year, it comes out the next year, I postulated that there's a tremendous amount of information available, that if somebody has the right access to the right computers, then they can find out pretty much anything about anybody. Which at the time I thought, I wonder if people are going to believe that. And of course now, in the intervening period,
the NSA knows a lot more about Jack Reacher than we even thought.
Absolutely. You just literally, like they say, you cannot make this stuff up. The reality is always more astonishing.
Do you consult with military personnel, FBI agents and the like? Do you ever get letters from readers who are in the service or law enforcement telling you that you've gotten it right or you got it wrong?
Yeah, all the time. And the military, it tends to be very rank-dependent. Reacher was terminal at major in the backstory. He was a promoted major and then quit. And typically in the military, majors and below are big Reacher fans because they kind of identify with him. Lieutenant colonel and above, they're not Reacher fans because they kind of contemplate the nightmare it would be to have such a person in their chain of command. A lot of cops, a lot of retired FBI, a lot of very generous, helpful people say, you know, check things with me, run it by me, which I do occasionally. But if I have something that I think is just on the edge, just a bit outlandish, I will check it with one of those people, and they say, yeah, sure, that happens. And so, you know, pretty much everything happens in real life. In a way, it's fiction that is actually cautious and rather limited. Real life is wild.
My guest is Lee Child, who's the author of 18 New York Times bestselling Jack Reacher thrillers. Eight of them were number one on the list, and all have been optioned for major motion pictures, although only one was made into a film, one shot, not that long ago, with Tom Cruise as Jack Reacher. The book that we're talking about is Never Go Back. And the book begins where the last one, A Wanted Man, left off. Was that your plan when you realized that you were going to start writing a series, that you would pick up the next book pretty much right after the last one ended?
Not originally, no. What I thought I would do was just present them as very honest kind of standalone adventures that happened possibly a year apart and were unconnected one with the other. But of course, at the beginning of a series, you have to take a decision, who is the guy? And you generally speaking make him a mature adult at that point. I mean, you don't start out with Jack Reacher, boy detective. He has to be fully formed, so he was 36 years old in the first book, which I felt was a reasonable age. You know, by that point, you've got some experience, you've got some abilities, you're probably at the peak of your performance.
And he's a major. He's not a major at 22.
No, exactly. I think for the type of white knight story that we've got here, he has to have been a knight, metaphorically speaking, which means, you know, West Point graduate and a commissioned officer. And I made him mid-30s because that's what I felt he should be. But then, of course, happily, delightfully, the series became a success and has continued. And as you said, 18 books. Well, if you add 36 and 18, you're getting up there in age. And so latterly, what I've stopped doing this one separate story a year. I thought, well, you know, one way around this age issue is if we link, say, three or four books together. So instead of 3 or 4 years' worth of stories, it's really just 3 or 4 weeks' worth of stories.
And you've also cheated a bit by having a few prequels.
Yeah, the prequels stall. They freeze time for a year at a time. And I've sort of stopped emphasizing a little bit his age. I started out being very honest about it. He was a year older in each book. But of course, I can't carry that on because Reacher, the sort of things that he does, the things the readers like, he can't be doing that in his aluminum walker, you know. He can't get too much older.
He doesn't come out of the Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, Mickey Spillane mold. He's not a private eye. He's not an alcoholic. He doesn't carry a gun. Did you have a specific model in mind when you created him?
Not really. What I had was things to avoid, as it were, negative models. And that, you know, the alcoholic thing was one of them. That way back when that was first introduced, the dysfunctional character, the suffering character, of course, it was fresh and it was new and it was interesting. But then everybody imitated it for years and years and years until all of these guys are alcoholics and they're divorced and their daughter won't speak to them and all that kind of stuff. And I was tired of it. I thought, let's just go back to a simple time, a simple type of hero who is just normal. He doesn't really have the regrets. He doesn't have the dysfunction. And so I tried to leapfrog backward in time to a more historic type of hero.
And you've given him nothing but a toothbrush, a passport, and an ATM card. But then he just gets into trouble a lot. But I thought maybe there is a certain amount of Sherlock Holmes in him. His process often involves close observation of minute details, although Holmes had a cocaine problem. So I guess that kind of thing has been happening to fictional detectives for a long time.
It has, although, of course, when Sherlock Holmes was around, it was legal. You know, it wasn't seen as a problem as such. But, yeah, I love Sherlock Holmes. I love Sherlock Holmes both as a reader and I love him as a writer, because think about writing Sherlock Holmes. It's such a fabulous thing to do, because what you've got here is you are controlling both ends of the transaction so that Sherlock Holmes can make these predictions. And guess what? They turn out to be true because Sherlock Holmes is very smart. Actually, no, because Conan Doyle is making it true. So from the writer's point of view, Sherlock Holmes is just a beautiful magic trick.
You cover the country in these books. This one alone, Reacher and Turner travel from Virginia through West Virginia, Pennsylvania, on to California. Do you travel Reacher's route?
I do, pretty much. Not deliberately for the book. It's because I've done it for some other reason. And for instance, last year or the year before, I think I was at the West Virginia Book Festival, and I drove that same route to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, because I had to go and see the movie being made. And so, yeah, it struck me very much. It's a nice drive. It's full of interesting places, full of interesting people to meet. And so a couple of years later, when it's time to write a book, I remember that, and I use it.
This is the 18th in the series, and your readers have come to expect one a year at least. Has it become something of a job? Because this one, you've been praised by Janet Maslin for actually having a certain extra juice in this book.
Yeah, and that was very nice of her, and I try very hard. I mean, every book, I can't remember whether it was Joe DiMaggio or somebody said, you know, this might be the only time the kid sees me play. And so what I try and do with every book, I make it as if it was my first book and my last book, as if this is the only book I'm ever going to write, and so I put everything I can into it.
And have you ever considered bumping him off?
Once or twice, yeah, because, you know, I think given the nature of the person, he needs a definite end. He needs a sort of noble end. He can't just disappear. But on the other hand, I think that would be upsetting to the readers. You know, you reach a point where the readers do you the favor of investing in the character, and it would be gratuitous just to kill him off. It would upset a lot of people. So if and when the series ever does come to an end, I think he will just wander off into that sunset.
Although you do have a lower body count in this book than you have in some of the others. You played, had a cameo role in the movie that came out, was it last year?
Yeah, last December, yeah.
Do you foresee an acting career on top of your writing career?
Yeah, I would love to run one in parallel because that little cameo role got me called a featured extra, which meant I could get my Screen Actors Guild card. So now I'm entitled to say a line.
We're in the same union.
Yeah, so I can, if there are more movies, I'm definitely going to be in them all.
Some people were concerned that Tom Cruise is rather small and Jack Reacher is very large. Did that bother you?
Didn't bother me because I knew, I know that business a little bit from having worked in television, and there has never been a case where the person on screen matches exactly what the writer intended. I mean, it's just literally never happened. It's always different. And with Cruise, it was an extreme test. Obviously, the actor was going to be different than the book character, and this was the most extreme difference. But it worked. I thought it worked really well.
Lee Child will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 at the Barnes & Noble store on 82nd Street and Broadway. The latest Jack Reacher book, the 18th, is Never Go Back. It is published by Delacorte Press, and it has been my great pleasure to talk to Lee Child once again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.